listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that has the best return on equity in the business. That's largely because of him, Andrew Page, and me, Scott Phillips. Mr. Page, good morning.
Good morning. Although I prefer return on capital is more an appropriate measure of.
I would have thought you'd be a return on incremental invested capital.
Oh, well, there is that too. Yeah.
We will delve into some arcane mathematical calculations on returns in a little bit of time.
Before yes, stay tuned for that. That's, yeah, exactly. That's really a hook, isn't
how
it?
How exciting is that? Before we do that, how's your week been?
Really nice, mate. Yeah. Loving autumn.
Excellent.
No, things are really good. It's school holidays at the moment, so kids are around. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, life's good.
Very, very good.
Yourself?
Sorry?
Yourself? How was your trip?
Trip was great. I did Moreton Island. I don't know if I mentioned it before I left, but it was really nice. I didn't really know what to expect. We'd done Fraser Island before, which was brilliant. And kind of Moreton's the kind of the little sister and not often talked about in the same. It was really, really good. Yeah, hand fed some dolphins, which was cool. Okay. Snorkeled the wrecks around the island. So a Wobbegong shark and some turtles and a whole lot of reef fish and stuff. Just had a really nice, relaxing time. The weather was good. It was a really good few days. Thank you.
I think it was Jarvis Bay or something. It's years ago.
Right.
And I was snorkeling there and I sort of dived down. I was amongst the rocks and I saw a Wobbegong. And yeah. I didn't even know what that was, right? All I saw was a shark. And I can tell you, I pretty much like Wile E. Coyote ran on top of the water. You have never seen anyone. And breathlessly told my mate, and he goes, "Oh, they're perfectly harmless. So like, that may be so, but my rational brain was not in gear at that point in time. You're underwater and you see something that looks like a shark. You just get the hell out of there."
I'm with you. It's even though you know it's okay, and we've been pre-warned, so we get all that stuff. You still look at it and go, "Still a shark," as you say. Yeah. So yeah. I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure it's overreaction, but it takes a bit of time to get used to it. It was just a really, really awesome trip. The weather was beautiful. I drove up and drove back, so that was kind of fun driving to Queensland, 11 or so hours each way, which was broken up, but still a fun time. And yeah, jumped on the barge, the vehicle barge across from the mainland, which was really cool. And just it was far enough away that it honestly felt like you were somewhere different. You know, you could see the very, very vague outline of some of the Brisbane high rises in the far distance.
Okay.
But other than that, it's just far enough away that it feels you feel like you're on a tropical island. You kind of are.
Yeah.
But it's just a really nice way to disconnect and unwind a little bit.
That's beautiful. I was going to say that, you know, I don't mind a long car trip. Well, I never used to, but that was when I could put on my music and my podcast. You know, 11 hours of, at one stage it was the Wiggles, now it's more Taylor Swift and, you know, it's just, that can make it a bit longer.
There is that.
Apologies to all the Swifties out there, but my little girl loves it and I'm not as much a fan.
My playlist, I use Google Play or whatever it is, or YouTube Music it is now. And I don't know who or what YouTube thinks I am, but the combination of some of my stuff and some of the young bloke stuff, some of my wife's stuff, it's a very, very eclectic mix, put it that way.
Eclectic mix, yeah.
I definitely listen to any Taylor. He's not a Taylor fan, but there's plenty of other stuff. And it's actually fine. But yeah, at some point, you know what he's into? You know Weird Al Yankovic? Have we talked about this before?
I very much know Weird Al Yankovic. I'm a huge fan.
He has discovered Weird Al. I have no idea how.
He's got good taste.
And so because you can with YouTube Music kind of go, "Hey, play Weird Al Yankovic," it will just play all of his songs until you eventually turn it off. And that can I love Weird Al. At some point, that can go for a very, very, very long time.
That is true. Have you we probably should talk finance at some stage, but one last thought. Have you seen the Daniel Radcliffe movie about Weird Al?
No, I have not.
Excellent.
Is it? Okay.
He has done some really good films.
Right.
Yeah, he's really pivoted well from the Harry Potter stuff. Yeah, anyway, highly strong recommend. Strong buy.
I will check that out. So let's this is going to be a seamless segue. He does a song called Mission Statement, which is just if you've worked for any sort of corporate, that song is just it's kind of not hysterically funny, but it's bizarre and just weird. You know, all of the synergies and you know, rationalizing our capital and leveraging our assets and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, he's made this song out of all the garbage you see in these corporate presentations. Whether you're an investor or whether you're someone who's worked at one of these big companies, it's like, Oh man,
it's like, going to resonate. It just
shows how ridiculous the whole thing is. Yes, it's very, very good. So with that seamless segue, mate, let's get on to some of the finance news. The big one probably now, I will say, by the time this goes to air, we're recording this on Wednesday morning, Anzac Day on Thursday, so we're not recording on Thursday as we normally would. Mm-hmm. But Wednesday, late morning, the inflation numbers come out, so we haven't yet seen those. The next couple of weeks, though, will be the, I anticipate it with joy and excitement more than many people, but the federal budget is due. I think it's the 14th of May, I think it's being released. And mate, this is just interesting because, frankly, it does kind of impact on rates and what the RBA may decide to do. It impacts on the economy more broadly. Jim Chalmers came back from overseas and kind of gave the old doorstop press conference and said the global economy is, in his words, fraught and fragile, is the phrase he used. Mm-hmm. And kind of, potentially suggesting that there might be more stimulus in the budget, more cost of living relief, to use the very famous phrase these days. At the same time, some economists are coming out and saying, Treasurer, you're already running a stimulatory budget. You got tax cuts coming on July 1. You're going to throw even more money at the budget. You can kind of do that. But just remember, the RBA is going to look at that and say, well, if demand continues to run hot, we're going to keep rates where they are or maybe delay cutting them. It's an interesting question. There's politics all over this. There's economics somewhere in the mix. There's finance and money somewhere in the mix. It's an interesting challenge, mate. I kind of think I side with the economists most broadly. You and I have talked about this before, but given, I don't know your views on Keynesian economics more broadly, but given we are running that sort of system, we should have had a budget surplus somewhere in the order of $50 or $60 billion last year, given the huge, huge corporate tax receipts, big personal tax receipts, rock bottom unemployment benefits. I mean, if the budget's ever going to deliver a huge surplus, best unemployment numbers in 40 years and record corporate profits, if you can't deliver a really, really huge budget surplus at that point, then it goes to show what sort of structural damage the budget's already in. Whether there's a modest surplus or not, like a commodity prices this time around, is almost a moot point because you're still stimulating the domestic economy. The amount of money you're getting is just a function of overseas sales going up, not anything that's happening in the local economy. You've got something like a $50 billion structural deficit, if you believe the economists who try to estimate these things. I don't know, mate. I think there is room for people being looked after who desperately are struggling, because if you're on a fixed income or a low income and prices go up 10%, you're pretty much screwed. So we've got to do something, but adding more demand to the economy without some sort of offset, either in additional taxes or cutting spending somewhere else, just seems a recipe for keeping rates higher and kind of messing further with the economy.
Well, I mean, this is the problem with, I mean, not to get too much into it, this is the problem with the Keynesian mindset to my view. It's like, why we're not in a recession. Right? We're not. I know that there is, me, I'm the glass half empty kind of guy. There's a lot of things to be depressed about. But unemployment is super low.
It's not one of them. Exactly.
Yeah. Arguably, I know you've said before, too low, if you really want to be brutal with this kind of stuff. GDP is going forward. It's sort of, why are we stimulating? That does not make any sense to me whatsoever. And more to the point, there is, I would separate the idea of providing support where it's needed versus stimulating it. If your rationale is, there are certain sectors of society that need help, therefore we're going to stimulate the economy by building a bridge or something. It's like drawing a line between the solution and the remedy. It's a bit trickle down economics-y kind of stuff. Yeah. And so I have a problem with that. I just generally have a problem with government capital allocation decisions, because there's a bunch of poor incentives there, and there's a lot of things that get done in the name of the greater good, but there are various segments that benefit much more than others. And you kind of look at it and go, well, look, if you're really trying to sort of help certain people out here, you could have just...
There are ways to do it.
And what's crazy is we go to these elaborate lengths to sort of do this thing, and it doesn't work. A lot of money gets wasted and a lot of money goes to people who don't deserve it. And it's just like, you'd be better off just posting out a check to those that
literally
need it. You know what I mean? And it's sort of... I find all of that a little bit bizarre. I mean, I've never heard a treasurer say, things are brilliant and we've got nothing to worry about. Like, I would be sandbagging.
Like a drunken sailor. Yeah, yeah, fair.
They're always going to sandbag. So it's always like, oh, things are tough. And it sort of softens people up to the, well, look, things might not be, you know, things might not stay great forever. Mm-hmm. So Chalmers is going to say that, right? He's absolutely going to say that. But yeah, the madness of what is happening. You've got the central bank trying to do one thing and the government doing the other, and it's
correct.
Just-
that's the big issue, right? That's the bit that's it's very, very hard to. I think you can be sympathetic to the things a treasurer might try to do in the circumstances,
mm-hmm.
in isolation. But when, you know, serious people with serious policy ambitions should then say, right, so in the context of the economy, this is what the impact is, or this is what you do to make sure the negative impacts are curtailed. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit that's missing. I think you and I, like, you're kind of anti-Keynesian, probably, again, most pragmatically, because it's being misused. As we said in last week's episode, you're not anti the idea of it being used properly. It's the misuse of it that's the problem. And I think that's exactly kind of where we're absolutely aligned, is we should be running a multi-tens of billions of dollars of budget surplus right now, which, mm-hmm. if that happened, would help to offset the deficit spending elsewhere. It would be working perfectly, and that would be a great system. The alternative would be that you have a zero budget or, you know, a balanced budget every single year, which would mean in the bad years, massive cuts to welfare and education, mm-hmm. and health and whatever else, because there was no other way to save the money. If the tax receipts are down, what else do you do? Mm-hmm. I don't know that you'd want that to be the case. So I don't know how we'd go from this to something other than this, other than I think we're aligned that it's being misused badly by politicians of both stripes. And this is the challenge, is if you're going to run Keynesian economics, you run deficits in the bad years, then you run surpluses in the good years and they offset each other and you're away. Yeah. It's that lack of, frankly, ticker, spine, whatever you want to call it, from our policies to say, actually, you know what? And by the way, if you want to run as massive surplus as they should right now and say, but people are still doing it tough, great. Let's mm-hmm. cut spending here to give money over here. Or let's mm-hmm. raise taxes there to put money into the economy mm-hmm. over here. You want to have an impact that isn't just adding fuel to an already overheated fire. Mm. End of the day, you know, we kind of want to be careful what we wish for, right? Because interest rates, again, regardless of your thoughts on the RBA, that's the system we've got. They're not going to come down anytime soon if the RBA looks around and says, but hang on, Treasurer, you want rates to come down, but this is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the dishonesty of government, mate. I won't rant for too much longer, but when Chalmers says we're doing everything we can to deal with inflation or the cost of living, it's not. I mean, there is. They've done absolutely. They've actually increased spending since taking power. Now, I will say again, as I try to be, not I never try to be balanced, but I always try to be fair. The last government left a massive structural deficit as well. So you know, they were given a wootsie sandwich to eat. The treasurer then said, "Well, I'm going to keep munching and make it worse rather than better." Yeah. So you know, pox on both their houses. But the comment of we are doing what we can, or we're doing our best, or whatever the phrase is, just a. I won't say it's a lie because that'd get me in trouble with the treasurer. It's an untruth. It's a truthy statement. If they were trying to do more, they would be cutting spending. They would be increasing the size of the surplus right now to take heat out of the economy to help the RBA if they genuinely wanted to have that impact.
Yeah. Well, I won't go into it again, but just to say that's why I don't like it. It's not that I don't like the theory. Theory's great. It doesn't work. The best analogy is communism. It's like, well, yeah. I mean, that's probably a really good system if you had incredible decision making at the top, but you don't. So therefore, it's not. And everyone's accepted that that's not a good system.
Right.
We cling to this idea with, oh, Keynesianism works in theory, but it doesn't work in practice. And yet we stick with it. So it's kind of, you know, that's I guess, the issue that I have with it.
I need to be a pain. I think it does work in practice, but is being misused in practice. I think that's important because Keynesianism does work in practice when it's done properly.
So it's not, but it's never done properly.
It has been.
Speaking of the budget, I mean, how many deficits have we had? What has been... So actually, not just the budget, the actual deficit. Well, yeah. I think over the last 10 years, we've had 7 out of 10 correct. Have been in deficit. And those that correct. Weren't was like a Hail Mary thank you from a commodity price slip. Like, so it's kind
actually
of
both
like...
times. Yeah, exactly.
Exhibit A. It's just like, well, it's not really working there, guys. I think it doesn't mean that you can't spend more than you take in times that are needed.
Correct.
But it's just sort of like we have so... it's like trying to wrap your kids too much in cotton wool. You actually don't do them any favors. And I think that's the same at a societal level with trying to manage economies, is that You know, we haven't had a recession, a proper one, since the 90s.
Correct.
You know, and we're doing all of this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know.
We're jumping at shadows. Yeah.
Yeah, we really, one day, I don't know when or how, what the reason, there's going to be a real crisis. And, you know, our debt's only gone in one direction. Correct. We're completely unbalanced in our spending. And then it's sort of like, huh. And I would say what you would find that in those years, in a that you would spend more than you took in, but the excess you would have to borrow, and the excess you would borrow from the private market. In other words, you would be able to do that because investors would look at you as a prudent, reasonable counterparty, exactly. And be happy to do that, right?
And at a reasonable rate too, by the way.
At a reasonable rate.
You can lend borrow as much as you need and without paying extortionate rates because you're a good risk.
Okay. And then, you're a good, things have turned, you're better, you know, you've got a surplus, you're going to pay me back and everything's, and we're going to go back to where we were. But again, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And so you get to this scenario where, I mean, the US is, that's the one you've got to point to. It's the biggest economy, and they're the ones that are really doing it in a bizarre way, because they go to the private market and the private market goes, we're tapped out. I am not interested in your debt. And so they go, okay, well, I guess we'll buy it ourselves. And I guess we'll make up the money to do that. Now that is like where things go, you really threw the looking glass.
Correct.
You've got points now where it's like, and the bigger, historically, at least more in recent history, China has been the biggest buyer, you know, and they're going, no, they're winding down their exposure here because they know, I know I'm going to be made whole on this investment. There is no question in my mind that on a nominal basis, this bond will be repaid.
Yeah.
But it's probably going to be repaid with a much higher base of M2 money in the system. And it's therefore what really matters is I don't want the number to be repaid. I want the purchasing power to be repaid. And the world is just waking up to the fact that it's just sort of like, no, that's not what is going to happen here. And this is coming back to interest rates here. This is why interest rates are going to stay higher for longer. They just, you can't sell your crappy debt, pardon my French, because no one's going to want it. Unless to entice that, you're going to have to raise interest rates, or the market won't pay as much for your bonds, and there are an inverse relationship there. So that interest rates are going to be higher for longer. I've said it before. I'll say it again. It's this idea that there's going to be this aggressive cut in interest rates is just not tenable. And if it is, it's going to be done at a massive expense of significant monetary base inflation and ultimately price inflation.
Which again has an interest rate response, and around and around we go.
Around and around we go. And it all comes back to having a prudent financial management of the system, you know, which we don't have.
That's right. And that's exactly where we come back to the same point, which is, you know, look, to be fair, we are, some people have said to me, and they're right, we are probably the least sick man in the hospital. Which is a nice position to be in a relative sense, but in an absolute sense, we're still in the hospital, we're still sick. Yeah. I think that's, you know, I think those who would say Chalmers can do whatever he wants because, hey, at least we're not America, or at least we're not whatever, in a relative sense, that's absolutely true. I am reminded, though, of, and I don't think it's not that, well, maybe you think it is, I don't think it's as bad as the GFC, but, you know, Australia's banks, TD Bank in Canada, said, actually, you guys are kind of mad. We're not going to play that game. Mm-hmm. And the other ones left standing. For a long time, they looked stupid, you know, and the equivalent would have been someone saying to the Commonwealth Bank, well, the rest of those guys are all borrowing, you know, you're buying collateralized debt obligations. They're all investing in mortgage-backed securities. You should do it too. Just do a little bit. You're not taking quite as much risk as Lehman Brothers or Morgan Stanley. You're only half as bad. That's fine. You know, they're worse than you. It's like, yeah, but it doesn't make it right. And I think when you follow that relativism kind of game, it becomes really, really dangerous.
Yep. So hey, anyway, yep. I just don't see. We'll finish the conversation. What changes here? And it's not trying to be cynical, but do we think that all of a sudden the government is going to make the hard necessary decisions? No. And it's not just this government, the other government. None of the current options that are available are going to make that decision because we're all to blame, right? Because we get the politicians we deserve. Yeah. And the person who gets up there and says, vote for me, I'm going to do some really difficult things that are going to make life more painful for you in the short term versus the other person who says, I'm just going to kick this can down the road and here's some free money. Like it's and I don't see that changing. I don't see how it possibly changes. And therefore it's just a question of, well, how tight do we pull the rubber band before it snaps? And I don't know, maybe there's a way to go, but I don't see how things reverse course.
I saw a great, meme, and it's probably political in its origin, so I'll divorce myself from whoever posted originally, whatever they originally meant, and all that kind of stuff, because it gets just silly. But a great meme this morning was tweeted at me in response to something I'd written, and it was teach a man to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. Give a man someone else's fish and he'll vote for you. That was great.
Yeah, that is brilliant. Yeah,
it sounds pretty libertarian or whatever. I said I don't know the origin of it. If it's by someone I don't like or shouldn't like or whatever, forgive me for it. But it was just a nice idea of like that's kind of exactly it, right? Of which government. And this is the other problem of speaking of moral hazard. I've got a line I use to describe businesses where I say you can only be as profitable as your least rational competitor allows you to be.
That's so true.
I think the equivalent in politics is you can only be as responsible as your least rational opposition lets you be, because at some point you do need this bipartisan idea of like, hey, let's not overdo each other's promises. Let's not out-promise each other in an aim to destroy the economy quicker so we can get a few votes. Yeah. You know, if you say, as you said, you go to the market, look, here's what I'm going to actually increase taxes and cut spending and pay back the debt because it's the responsible thing to do. Mm-hmm. Now the guy says, oh, it's fine. Here's some money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very difficult thing to win. And frankly, that's what I partly hope, mate, for all of my sins and all of my optimism, maybe some Pollyanna-ishness too. That's kind of what I hope this podcast helps people with, is we're trying to kind of open some of these issues up and kind of give our listeners a bit of a sense of what's going on here, just so they can be more informed and hopefully, I don't know, it's almost certainly pushing the proverbial uphill, but you know, at some
there's
point,
no free lunch. There's no well, free
if
lunch.
If enough is the hard care, though, truth, we may start to change something. That's again, maybe it's Pollyanna-ish. Maybe it's a ridiculous cross to bear. But I just think you and I, frankly, many more people than you and I have a responsibility to help some people understand some stuff. And if this conversation helps people realize that maybe they should be asking our representatives to be a little bit more responsible, then hopefully we've added some small part to improving the quality of the conversation.
Yeah, and the other thing I would say too is because that may take a while for that to happen. So what can I do? What can I do? I can certainly play my role in this grand democracy of ours, but I can at least try and look after my self-interest.
Yeah.
And there is a very obvious divide between the haves and the have-nots. And we've talked many times how that gap is widening and what's the key difference there. Having a nice income helps. It's assets. Whatever happens, if you look at things through a monetary lens, no matter how bad things get, if you own something scarce with genuine intrinsic value, you will be much better off. Now, whether that's a property or whether that's a really high quality business or whatever it is, you can't. There's only one CSL on the planet. You know, there's only one Cochlear on the planet. There's only one Woolworths on the planet. There's only one straw man on the planet. and you want to own those things. Now, again, you don't want to throw everything out the window valuation-wise and the rest of it.
Yeah.
But that is in an environment where we do not have prudent financial management. And there is going to be an increasing number of units just continually flooded into the system. You know, If there is no scarcity in the money, there will be scarcity in the assets, and that is what you want to own. I suspect, I don't know if this is really well thought through, but for the longest of times when things were run a bit more prudently, we as investors would kind of look at these long-term averages and go, I think about a 10% return is what I sort of demand from the market. I think those risk premiums are going to go down a bit. I think a lot of people will be happier to accept less when the positioning flips from profit, like appropriate hurdle rates, to get technical, versus I just want to preserve my capital. It's all I want to do.
Yeah.
And I've kind of flipped a bit on this. So for you and I, for the longest time, whenever we talk about things like Woolies, which I think is a great, business, got some social issues, but it's a business, it's a great business. Yeah. And I've always looked at it, and I don't own it because I look at it and go, the valuation makes no sense.
Yeah.
And then it just occurs to me, it's just like, because I look at it and go, I think if I bought Woolies shares, my assumption is over the next 10 years, I'll probably average 5-7% per annum with dividends and all everything sort of all in. And for me, that's not high enough. And then the epiphany was, actually, it's probably perfectly high enough for a lot of people whose main consideration is capital preservation.
Oh yeah, totally.
I wonder if the monetary situation mm-hmm. gets worse and the fiscal management continues to deteriorate, more and more people will come to look at that as that store of value proposition, as opposed to that return proposition. And my worry, and what am I trying to say here? I'm thinking I might need to be a little less militant on my hurdle rate expectations. You know, it's just like, I will only buy Woolies if I can guarantee if I can be very confident of 10 to 12% per annum. Like, because I might not ever get that opportunity. In fact, that's been the recent, you know, 5, 6, 8 year history of Woolies is like, for those waiting for a PE of long-term average of 16,
right, exactly.
you just don't get the shares,
yeah, get
right?
It. Yeah.
Is that wrong, do you think? I look at property as well, right? And I've always, you know me, right? I'm shaking my fist at the sky going, who on God's green earth is happy to accept a 2.5% gross yield? It makes no sense. And then you go, wait a second. It's not about that. It's about just preserving the capital. I don't know. What do you think?
That's a really good point, mate. I suspect that the bulk of the weight of people investing in those assets are not doing it for the reasons you suspect. Mm. So if they are lucking into the right decisions, I don't think a lot of property investors have gone, you know what, it's not about the tax deduction, it's not about the capital gain, I just want to preserve my capital. I reckon there's 4 investors out there doing that with property. The rest are chasing the tax deduction and the capital gain. With Woolies, I suspect I think it's a safe thing in terms of being blue chip and that just being a continued issue. I don't know. My speculation would be that your reasoning, though it may be right, is probably not what the vast, vast, vast bulk of people are doing it for. So if they get it right, they might get it right for the wrong reasons. Would be my guess.
Yes, but I'll just quickly on that. They are fake gains that people are chasing.
Yeah.
So let's say you bought an investment property 4 years ago and it's gone up 20%.
Yeah.
It's a wash. You broke even. In purchasing power terms, you're, there is no return. You've made a 0% real return, right?
My argument, though, is 4 years ago, they weren't doing it to preserve the capital. That was never their aim. No. I reckon there's probably four property investors around the country who are doing it for capital preservation. The rest are doing it for the gains. And as fake as they might be, they're not doing it with inflation in mind. They weren't doing it to combat, you know, four years of persistently high inflation. They were doing it because they want to make a lot of money. And if inflation happened to be higher, then, oh, bugger, I didn't get as much as I thought I did, as opposed to the other way around, where they were like, I'm going to have inflation, therefore I'll buy property just so I maintain my purchasing power, which is kind of your argument. So the question I would have for you, mate, and I haven't thought this through either because this is a new conversation we're having. If we do also say there's more units chasing the same assets, arguably we may well get the increase. You're talking about a nominal increase of 9 or 10% a year. Mm. We may get a nominal increase of 9 or 10% a year anyway. It just may be worth less. So I would suspect
definitely
that if you don't
definitely
yeah. yeah. So if you're not looking at a real return of 6 versus a nominal of 9, for example, just round numbers.
Yep.
I would suspect that if you're right about your demand, you know, the amount of money chasing the assets, there's only the same number of assets, that in theory, the money chasing assets will push those assets up. Mm. I suspect if you're right about all of that, you'd actually get more than a 6 or 7% return because you'll have that inflation, which would, if it's all happening, either come about because of higher profits, and again, higher paper profits rather than real mm-hmm. profits, or a higher PE because more people chase it. So I would suspect, and this is absolutely off my head, I would suspect there's no change. You get your 10% anyway, because while you might look at the capital preservation bit, at the same time, you're all that money chasing that capital preservation bit, that probably has the impact of pushing the price up anyway. So I would imagine in that scenario, they probably net each other out, but that's just off the top of my head.
No, but that's it, right? That's kind of my point, where it's sort of like, again, the people who are at this exact point in time, looking out over the last 5 years and go, it doesn't actually seem that bad to me, are the people with assets, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'll make the argument, and you're right, no one else is probably thinking this, but, well, not many, but it's like, I'd say, well, you haven't actually, you've made a nominal gain, you haven't made a real gain.
Correct.
It's like,
exactly.
Yeah, but I've still done a hell of a lot better than someone who didn't own assets.
That's exactly right.
Because the person who didn't own assets, their savings have dropped. So they're now 80% of their savings.
And your wages haven't gone up as fast, so you're in the hole twice.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, there is, it's not a terrible situation on a relative basis.
Yeah.
If we continue along this path and you look back in 10 years and go, actually, oh, I made this nominal gain, which is really nice, but the real return is awful. It's like, yeah, but it's still better than if I was just in cash or,
correct,
you know,
correct,
I wasn't fortunate enough to do it. And so again, acquire assets, save and acquire good quality assets. It's not, I'm not saying it's going to be a path to riches and maybe your purchasing power terms don't change that much, but relative to those that don't, you will be significantly, significantly better off. And, it will always be better to have a very high real return. Yes, of course, yes, it will be. But I tell you what, though, given the choice between a lump of, you know, just holding a melting ice cube that's melting faster and faster, and something that's just basically managing to stay frozen but not growing, I'm torturing this analogy. But it's still a pretty good outcome, I would say.
Can I extend that, mate, into investing land for a sec? Because you've taken us in the right direction. I have two thoughts. One is that the real and nominal thing, and just we kind of use those terms too easily. Nominal means just the numbers that you see, right? If something goes from 10 to 11, it's gone up 10%. That's the nominal return, just the numbers return. The real return, or quotes real, I don't like real because it's sort of, it's not like the other one's not reality, it's just a different.
I love real. I think it's perfectly describes.
The real return is after you subtract inflation from the return. So you go from 10 to 11, you're up 10%. But if inflation was 5%, to make my maths easier, even though you've gained 10% in nominal terms, you've actually only gone ahead 5% in real terms because the other 5% is effectively just covering inflation. So that's
if that doesn't make sense to you, go and open up a bank account in Lebanon because they're going to give you 30% interest, right? It's very simple. It's very simple. It's like the numbers don't matter. It's what I can get. I've got this bit of paper, or more accurately, a record in a bank's database.
Yep.
And what can I exchange for that? That's correct, the only thing that matters.
Correct. So I think that's really important. And I think it's worth thinking about. For the longest time, well, for 30 years, maybe 40, 35 anyway, inflation's been reasonably dead. And so investors haven't needed to do that maths in any meaningful way. As company investors, by the way, when you're looking at a company's numbers, don't be fooled by revenue growth that is just pumped by higher prices. If the costs are going up at the same time. There was a time you'd say 5-10% revenue growth, great. They sold 10% more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
These days you get 10% revenue growth, you gotta say, well, hang on, how much was the price up? Because the price, if the price is up and the costs are flat, then that's even better because that's pure profit. But most of the time these days you can say, well, hang on, my cost of goods are up 10%, my sales are up 10%. Well, all I've really done is sold the same number of things.
Yep.
There is no prosperity there. There is just treading water. And that's the other time when nominal and real is important, to understand how fast is your company actually growing in any meaningful way. At the end of the day, you want them to sell more units, again, at higher margins if you can. But higher prices don't matter much if all you're doing is covering your costs. So,
it's better to tread water than to sink, right?
Exactly.
Like, again, it's relative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I guess the two things I wanted to draw out of this, mate, and two quick points. Feel free to comment on either or both. First thing is, when you are investing, I think you talk about the 9% return or the 6% return or the 7% return. As investors, you can choose to only invest when you get a certain level of return. In other words, I'm going to keep cash until that point.
Mm-hmm.
I've said before, I prefer not to keep cash. And so for me, as much as I just poo-pooed relativism before about the budget stuff, I'm looking for the highest return investments I can find.
Yep.
And if the best return I can find is 5%, because everything is really expensive, I'm going to take the 5, right? Because mm-hmm. the alternative is, as you said, mate, staying in cash and having that erode. Now, if I can find 7, I'll take that. If I can find 9, I'll take that. So for me, while the absolute numbers are important, realistically, it's only ever a relative gain above a threshold. No point buying a -2 instead of a -5 because you might as well stay in cash at that point.
Yeah.
But if you can get 7 or 8 or 10, take it. And so while we talk about, you know, what can we likely assume we'll get, I think it's a worthwhile thought experiment and expectation setting. But for me, it's like, well, am I going to buy Woolies? I'll buy Woolies if that's the best return I can get.
Mm.
If it's 6, well, so be it. If it's 9, even better. If I can invest somewhere else and get 12, I'll take that. So it's kind of a relative game for me. The other thing I'll quickly add is just we've said this a little bit before, but I want to really bang it home. For all the inflation conversations we've had, the beauty of investing assuming inflation is if it doesn't happen, you're even better off.
Yeah.
And if you're investing in a world where inflation is definite, guaranteed, probable, likely, possible, not possible, not likely, any of those scenarios, a business that has the best pricing power is still going to win 99 times out of 100.
Yep.
And so what's important is, again, over the last 35 years, you haven't had to think about pricing power because businesses have never needed to use it. Economies were growing, inflation was low. Everyone, rising tide lifted all boats. Mm. At times of inflation, if we are going to have a period of sustained inflation, I'm less confident than you are, mate, that rates remain, you know, higher than they otherwise might be. But whether I'm right or you're right, buying quality companies with inflation protection, in other words, pricing power, is better in both scenarios. And this is one of those things where you get to plan for the worst and still win.
Yep.
You know, heads I win, tails I still win is a pretty good scenario. So I would encourage our listeners just to, when they're picking their stocks, just think very cleverly or clearly about what happens in times of inflation. Does this business have price? Can they pass it on? As you said, mate, better to tread water than sink. And if you know, X percent of the market is going to sink because they can't pass it on, they're not the business you want to be. You don't want to be in commodity companies. You don't want to be in businesses with no pricing power. Yep. You want to have pricing power. So at least in a relative and absolute sense, you're much better off.
Well, that's Woolies, right?
Can we talk about Woolies?
Let's talk about Woolies. Let's talk about the Senate hearing.
Yes, that. They good segue. Seamless, mate.
Beautiful.
We are on fire. Can I pull the curtain back just a touch for a second? We're on Zoom here, and Andrew is writing his notes with a red pen with a fluffy ball on top with antlers, best I can tell, and a little heart at the front. And I only say that because I'm trying to keep a straight face and keep this podcast going. I see this little pen kind of fluff around in front of me, and it's a... it's
my like little girl has been writing on the desk, and I've been looking around for a pen, and this is all I've got. So, yeah.
There you go.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Fascinating conversations this week. So speaking of holidays, mate, I only did, I think, two media things. One I forgot to cancel, so I kind of felt obliged. The other one, I got a phone call from ABC Statewide Drive, New South Wales, and it was, I think it must have been Wednesday, and it was in the morning. It's like, hey, can you come on Drive this afternoon and explain ROE to everybody? I'm like, oh, man. Talk about a hard assignment, right? You want me to explain to a radio audience who aren't finance people with no graphs or pictures or numbers, hey, talk about ROE for me. Talk about return on equity. It's like, yeah, I'll do that. I think I did a half-decent job. The producer seemed happy enough when I'd finished. Yeah. But it all came about because Woolies was asked in a very heated exchange with Senator Nick McKim and Woolworths CEO Brad Banducci, effectively words to the effect of the Senator saying, Mr. Banducci, can you confirm Woolworths return on equity is 26%? And Brad Banducci did his absolute level best to not answer that question. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you. At which point,
we use return on capital.
Point Nick McKim, he did, that's right, got even more frustrated and threatened him with contempt of the Senate, which I thought was a slight overreach and maybe a little bit too over the top. But it was a fascinating exchange. And of course, Brad Banducci is the same bloke who walked out of a 7:30 report interview. So he's not exactly covering himself in PR glory. And yet...
What a self-owned goal. Like, just answer the question. Like, because you can say yes. Yep. That is true because it is objectively, factually true and it's unarguable. Then make the point that you were trying to make. But just to not answer it, I just kind of felt it was just like, Brad, come on.
Can I say, mate, I reckon that whole exchange was about the worst of the Australian Parliament.
Yeah.
Because firstly, you're right. Banducci was obviously counselled not to say the number or not to agree with it or something going
on. Did that help? Did that help, though?
Like, no, I agree with you.
If he had just gone yes and then answered and then somebody said, we wouldn't be talking about it right
now.
It's called, isn't it called the Streisand effect or something? It's like the effort to, yeah, so it comes from when Barbara Streisand tried to hide something about one of her properties. Okay. And the very act of trying to hide it highlighted it. So it's called the Streisand effect. And so this is the genius. And this is where the PR people advising him need to be fired. It's just you have given him this advice because you don't want to talk about it. But by doing that, you have made the entire country talk about it. You idiots.
I'm on Statewide Drive trying to explain it to people because Brad Banducci won't answer the question.
You never would have been otherwise.
Yeah. Now, that said, The question from the senator was also, frankly, stupid. And he knew the answer. So what was this about? This was about a senator trying to start a line of argument, which is, hey, Woolies, you're obscenely profitable because your ROE is 26%. Isn't that right, Mr. Banducci? And so you're right. Nick McKim's trying to set up a bit of a gotcha kind of line of questioning where he gets to narrow and narrow and call Brad Berducci all sorts of names, if not directly, at least implied. Brad Berducci knows what he's trying to do and so tries to avoid it, and therefore causing the problem that it's created, as you say, mate. That's what I mean about the whole thing being about the worst of it. The question was dumb. The answer was dumb. The whole thing is just a blight on what otherwise this inquiry has never been about trying to uncover the truth or trying to find solutions to perceived problems. It's not even about trying to define the problem. It's about saying, people are complaining about the cost of living. I am going to bash up the supermarkets. It makes me feel better and looks like I'm doing something. If I get Brad Berducci to say
it's definitely not our fiscal policy, everyone. Look at those guys. It's definitely not all of this debt. But and even, profligate correct. Spending and like let's not talk about that. Let's talk about Woolies.
Right? Ironically, though, this is from the Greens, who weren't part of any of that stuff and still just want to make a populist point about I'm bashing up the bad man at Woolies who's charging you a fortune for your cheese.
Yeah,
it's just the whole thing is just it's political theatre gone bananas. As you say, the government wants to cover it up. The Greens don't care about covering up, want to make some cheap political points. And here we are. And it's like, you know, the opposition group is in there going, this is great. I don't have to do anything. It's anyway.
Let's define it, right. Shall we?
Correct.
Okay, I'll go. So return on equity is pretty much what it says. It's the return you have on the net assets of your business, otherwise known as equity. So when you look at the balance sheet, you have all the assets, you have all the liabilities, equity's the difference. You can also define it as the amount of money that was put into the company to set it up, plus all retained profits. They're both equivalent.
Same mathematically.
Same thing.
Calculated differently, but you end up at the same point.
Conceptually, it's different. Like, I find it handy to think about it in one of those two ways, depending on the context. Yes. So go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to the example I gave, mate, was just a rental property, because people understand property a lot more easily. So people know what their home equity is, funnily enough. And when we talk about equity in a company, people kind of, it's just harder to grasp. But it's the same thing.
Glaze over.
You own a $1 million house. You've got a $750,000 mortgage. You have $250,000 of equity.
Easy.
I think we all know that.
Super easy.
And the companies are exactly the same. What do they have? Machines and cars and stores and fittings and whatever else. What do they owe? Well, they owe money to their suppliers who bought, they owe some employee entitlements, got some debt. That's all the stuff they owe. Now, you take the difference apart, and with a home, it's $250,000. Now, we talk about, and this is, by the way, the power of gearing and leverage, which works both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the equity part. The return part is just take your profit and divide your profit into the equity. So, in this case, let's just make my life easy. Let's say you're getting $25,000 a year in rent from the, or not rent, rent less expenses from your property. You own $1 million property. You got $750,000 debt.
Including tax.
Yes, including tax, including the interest-free payments. Everything else comes out of it.
Yep.
And you have $25,000 left at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Your $25,000 worth of profit in that year divided by the $250,000 worth of equity means your return on that equity is 10%. In other words, the stuff you've put into it, and again, your point about what you pay to set it up, less any of the retained, or plus any of the retained earnings, actually works exactly the same way. Yeah. So let's say you put in $250,000 in cash, you borrowed the rest, you're getting $25,000 return a year. Mm. That's a 10% return per year on your equity, the money you put into the property. And the same is exactly the same. The case is exactly the same with companies as well.
Yep. And it's entirely appropriate. Let me just slightly go in a different direction here.
Go on.
This is why property only makes sense with debt.
Yeah.
Because the alternative, to use your example, is return on, there's actually a million ways to do it. Return on assets, return on return on just capital. So the return on capital is just sort of like saying, well, forget the equity. What of all of the capital base that I'm dealing with? Is all my assets plus my long-term debt. This is the money I've got. Forget about how I've structured the balance sheet. Yep. I've got this much money. So in this case, you've made $25,000 on your investment property.
Yep.
But the capital is $1 million.
Yeah, which is the total assets effectively.
Which is, basically, yeah.
Yes.
And so you've what's that? What's that return?
2.5%.
This is where I sort of scratch my head and go, that is a really bad asset. It can, and people are right to point out, like, yeah, but that with debt is actually quite good. It's like,
correct.
Yeah, that's
both,
true.
Both are true, by the way.
Both are true. Both are true. But there's no free lunch. There's, I can, my return on equity, there's so many different directions to go here. If I was a CEO and I was incentivized, my bonus depended on return on equity.
Yep.
That which gets measured gets done. That which gets incentivized gets done. I would very easily get my bonus because I would probably just take on a bunch of debt.
Of course, you would.
You know,
you may not to.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, without doing anything, my return on equity, because I'm just going to erode the equity base there. Is that appropriate? I don't know. Return on capital. Brad's right. You know, that is an appropriate measure. I'm just like, I need to sort of look at the return I am getting with the assets I am deploying. And on that basis, it's not as good. So
tell me why it would matter, mate. Why? I mean, you know, if you can, every property investor listening to this says, well, who cares about the assets? I don't, you know, I didn't put the money in for the assets. I only put the equity in.
Yeah.
I'm getting a cash return from that.
Yeah.
Like that, money is money. That's all I care about. The asset could be worth $55 million or you know, $1 million or $500,000. If I'm only putting in $250,000, I'm getting $25,000 a year back.
Yeah.
I'll take that every day. I mean, effectively, as shareholders, that's what we do. When we invest in shares in a company, we don't take on a portion of the debt either. We just say, well, yeah. I'll take the equity. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So why, in what circumstances would it be worthwhile comparing the two, and what would make one better or worse than the other?
I think when you look at return on capital, it tells you the economic attractiveness of the undertaking that you're doing. And then return on equity is just sort of saying, well, how is that relative to me and what I have put in? So you often get companies that are pretty ordinary type businesses in terms of what those assets are generating. Yep. And it only makes sense to sort of gear it up to make sure that the numbers make sense. And frankly, I prefer return on equity when looking at shares. I think that's the appropriate measure. I'm the shareholder. This is the equity that is you know, apportioned to me. What return can you get on it? Just bear in mind though that comes at a cost. If I see a company that has a very ordinary return on capital but a very attractive return on equity, it just means that they've taken on probably this maybe some mitigating circumstances at the fringe, but basically I've just taken on a bunch of debt. Yep. And that's cool. Particularly if I'm a toll road or I'm an airport or I'm something with lots of tangible, hard quality, long lasting assets that are real, that's probably not too bad. Yeah. But there is a cost to that. And the cost is if, like, you know, the cost of your debt goes up significantly or for whatever reason you can't meet a repayment or anything like that, you're in a much more precarious situation.
Correct.
What you really want is a business where you get insane returns on capital. You don't even need to leverage it. Yeah, or you can maybe even leverage it and get more.
You would, yeah.
Yeah. So the Green Senator was right, really, from a shareholder's perspective. They care about the return on equity, right? It's just make sure that doesn't come at the expense of over-leveraging the business.
So I pulled up the numbers here, mate, just for fun, out of Capital IQ. Woolworths return on equity last financial year, 25.7%.
Huge. Yeah,
they have $5 billion worth of equity.
Yeah.
They also have $27 billion worth of debt.
Yeah.
So their return on assets is only 5.5%. In other words, everything that's required to make Woolworths run, all of the money they had to put in, the shareholders put in and kept in, all the money they borrowed, that's all required to open the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And those assets combined make 5.5%.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. Now, Woolworths is a very high quality business, right? So from an investor's perspective, but if you had to fund Woolworths, I said you can buy Woolies outright and pay off all the debt, when you do that, you're going to get a 5% return.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, now again, I want to be really clear. Woolies is a high quality business in a lot of ways. Financially, not so much. Why? Because it's an incredibly capital intensive business. You need a lot of resources. You need
distribution
warehouses and
centers,
racking. And, right, exactly. You need staff. You need registers. You need lighting.
Property.
You need air conditioning. You need all that stuff. Everything that goes into it. And you're only making a 5% return on that, which, is, again, it's fine. Woolies is a great company. Their debt is pretty secure because, frankly, who doesn't go to Woolies at least once every month? And if you do, you probably shop at Coles. But combined, the supermarket businesses are going to be completely fine because they are the only game in town. Now, by the way, at some point in the future, if Amazon or Kogan or Drink or someone else takes over, you know, it's not guaranteed to be protected forever. Woolies is doing a really, really good job of fighting the online fight. I think that their online stuff is really great for what it's worth, I think. I don't know, shares in Woolies. But, you know, and that debt is going to be paid either way. And that's to Andrew's point, where the risk is, right? if everything goes fine, leverage is great. As Warren Buffett would say, leverage is the only way a smart guy can go broke.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, leverage magnifies gains and magnifies losses.
Mm-hmm.
You've used the example a lot of times, Ram, about banks. If you know, if property prices fall so much, their equity gets wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true of Woolies. I mean, they've only got, I say only, $5 billion worth of equity and $30 billion worth of debt.
Mm.
If you can't make those repayments, here's the other thing about debt, by the way, when interest rates go up, so your profit goes down. So those returns, you know, one of your key parts of your P&L is that interest line. If you've got a massive chunk of debt, you've got to pay the bill on that sort of stuff.
Mm.
So those are, you know, I don't know, mate. Banducci was silly to play silly buggers in the Senate inquiry. I thought the question was just, I was going to say dumb. It's clever because he was trying to make a political point.
Mm.
It had no policy value. No one knows what return on equity is to listen to that thing except for a couple of nerds like you, me, and most of our listeners. Most other people, what McKim wanted them to hear was, Woolies makes 26% profit? That's obscene.
Mm.
No, yeah, he wasn't going to try and explain it. He wasn't going to try and break it down. He wasn't going to try and explain why it was good or bad. Mm. He wasn't going to ask about the return on assets because why would you?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of, you know, it's public opinion manipulation, and every politician does. It's not just McKim; it's everybody for a particular point. And you know, maybe he made his point, maybe he didn't make his point. Maybe he looks like a genius and a hero to his voters or to people who might vote for him. Maybe he doesn't. Mm. And by the way, it's not just about the Greens. I'm not going to name individual others, but there's plenty of other senators who've done the same sort of thing in different contexts. That's what makes the whole thing a circus.
Mm.
Is 26% return on equity unreasonable, mate, if you're a supermarket? Does that suggest to you excess levels of profitability or anything that should be addressed?
I don't know if I could draw such a direct line. I mean, it does say to me that it is... I mean, look, the way they've chosen to structure themselves, they've extraordinarily profitable.
Yep.
Because the reality is, I mean, everything, you've got to look at everything through the lens of opportunity cost.
Yeah.
So it's never going to happen, by the way. But in theory, shareholders could vote to sell all the assets, pay off all the debt,
right.
And the equity is what they're going to get.
Take the money
That's
home.
What they're
exactly.
going to get.
Yes.
And now it's like, okay, now I've got my equity. What'd you say it was? $5 billion.
Yep.
$5 billion. I've got $5 billion.
Yep.
Where can I invest that and what kind of return can I get?
Yes. Yeah.
26% return. Well, that's a talking about hurdle rates.
Yeah.
Actually, no. Now that I've thought about it, don't sell the assets. Don't pay back the creditors.
Exactly.
Let's leave the equity there and let's keep getting a 26% return, because that is incredible. That is more than double the long-term average of equity markets. It is. Woolies is a very, very profitable business. And for anyone to suggest otherwise, now it's partly that because of the way they have structured themselves, but they can structure themselves that way. Who has the lowest cost of capital, debt capital in Australia? I reckon you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who has a lower cost than Woolies. If you, every bank in the land and in the world will lend money to Woolies, and that because it is such a it's such a safe pair of hands.
Yep.
So to say that, oh well, it's only that because we've chosen to leverage ourselves that way. But why wouldn't you leverage yourself? You'd be negligent not to do it because your debt. I looked at a company that I own the other day. They're paying 12% on their debt because they're a small. Unprofitable business. Like, well, I'll lend you some money, but it's not going to be the terms that Woolies get. Woolies enjoys those terms and will always be able to enjoy those terms. So I think if you want to talk about profitability on the money that I have or what you have collectively as shareholders, it is absolutely appropriate to look at return on equity. But again, as you said before, it's like they're both right. You know, return on capital tells you what's actually being generated off the assets at your disposal. That's absolutely relevant too. It depends on the question that you're trying to answer.
Yes.
And this is the point I always make with any kind of ratio analysis or fundamental analysis when you're looking at a company. People love to say, oh, you just look at this, and this will tell you everything you need to know. And if it's all green, then that's a buy. And we love these little formulas. But you need a holistic view. They will all tell you something different, and it's only when looking at all of them do you get a proper sense of it. And I just think when I look at Woolies, I just think that relative to the assets, it's not super profitable. But given the positionality of the business, given the access to funding, and that it is absolutely appropriate to leverage it to a reasonable degree, which they have, and that is the return that they get in by virtue of what they're able to do. And Yeah, it's a damn profitable business. It is absolutely a profit. I mean, look at the long-term returns. Return on equity is pretty much that you can draw. I won't do the maths, but you can relate that directly to earnings per share growth over time. And what really matters at the end of the day for me is, like, if my earnings on a per share basis rise, you know, that is going to be an incredible tailwind for the share price. And they can talk all day long about what their margins and return on assets and return on capital and all of this kind of stuff is, but the return on equity is very good. That's driven some really impressive return on equity, earnings per share growth, and that's helped drive the share price and dividend growth. It just has, a fact. So it's a very profitable business.
I think that's right.
Is it too profitable? That's the question. That's the question. I would say it is the duty of the board, their solemn duty as representatives of shareholders, to ensure that they get the best return that they possibly can. Now, they operate in society, and society is governed in the way that we do it, through a democracy. And we can decide, you know, how much market power someone should have and the rest of it. But as long as you're playing within the rules, fill your boots. Absolutely. Yeah. And don't get angry at Woolies, right? Like, we expect too much, I think, from these businesses that are profit oriented businesses. I'm not saying don't get upset by it. Absolutely. There's a lot of things to be upset by there. But you can't set up a playing field and a rule set, put players on the board, and then be upset when you don't like the result. Change the rules, right? But it's not the right thing to do. They should just do this because they're nice guys. Like, no, whenever you're reliant on people doing the right thing just because, and particularly when it comes at a personal expense to them, it's just like, you talk about being a Pollyanna. Like, that is just pure madness. So get angry. And there are reasons to be angry, but don't, I just kind of think, I would do exactly the same. If I was made the CEO of Woolies, and probably everyone will hate me now, I would do the same. I would charge as much as I possibly can, and I would operate within the rules. And if we as a society think that is inappropriate for whatever reason, then we should change that. Not just an appeal to morality, which is just not going to happen. And I've said long and hard many times before, it's just like, competition is the solution to this problem, and we should just do what we can to sort of foster that.
Yeah, I think it's funny, mate, speaking of people hating you. It's funny how we, or some people look at Woolies and say, they shouldn't take advantage of the opportunity, they should charge less. Mm-hmm. And I always kind of rhetorically ask people, when was the last time you said to your boss, look, I know you'd like to give me a 5% increase, but I probably only need a 3. I don't want to be too greedy. I don't want to profit you out of the inflation thing. I'll take 3%. Thanks, mate.
I'm worried about the broader economy, exactly. So I don't want the pay rise. Like,
exactly. And, you know, and I think it's not exactly the same, but it's not miles different.
No.
Can I go back to ROE just for a second, mate? I would simply say there is absolutely zero ability to draw any correlation between how profitable a business is and its ROE. Mm. If Woolies paid off every dollar worth of debt tomorrow, then it would go back to the Senate committee in a year's time and say, Senator, my return on equity has fallen from 26% to 5%, therefore I'm not making any money. Mm-hmm. Which would be equally as stupid, because it's just the capital structure, how the business is funded, nothing to do with the business itself. If it, by the way, went to the bank and said, actually, what I'd love to do is, can I borrow another $10 billion and I'm going to actually have negative equity, therefore my return on equity is incalculable. I have no cost of running this business. There's no shareholder funds involved at all. This is just a debt machine spewing out a whole lot of money. Then it'd be an infinite ROE, or not calculable ROE. Same thing. If they paid every dollar of equity down with debt to $1, the ROE would be in thousands and tens of hundreds of thousands of percent.
Yeah.
And it would be, again, the business would be just as profitable as it is today, not more, not less, just because the ROE is different. And this is where it's just a cynical kind of, you know, silly bugger play, because it was never about the profitability of the business under any reasonable metric, comparing the cost of the product that they bought or, the way the operations were run. This is purely a funding question, which the center either knew and chose to do anyway or didn't know, which is arguably, I'm not sure it's better or worse, actually. But it's neither is ideal. I would simply say it's ROE is irrelevant when it comes to the level of profitability and what's reasonable. And to your point, we should solve that with regulation or competition rather than trying to make them do something or expect them to because they're nice people. Even if that was true, 24% or 5% or 50% is irrelevant. All it talks to is the amount of debt, not the amount of profitability, the amount of dollar profit the company rakes in.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, except that the capital structure choices available to Woolies are vastly more attractive and wide than they will with other companies. So it does enjoy a I don't know if this is a privileged position. I don't know if that's the right term for it. It just does. So I totally get your point, but at the same time, it's just like, given everything, the way everything is, that. They would be mad not to structure it that way. Why would you ever do it? In fact, why wouldn't a competitor do it that way? Of course they're going to do it that way. So it's kind of, I know that they make these decisions on a return on, I don't know if we go in that direction, but a return on invested capital, which is a viewpoint, which is exactly the right viewpoint, by the way. I don't think you can ignore the fact that you do have that ability. Let me take it back to property. I don't, all of a sudden, someone made a rule that you can't borrow against property anymore. Mm. That proposition changes radically, right? But that's not going to happen, and I can, and therefore I do, and therefore return on equity is the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And so it is what it is. So to say that property investing would be really bad without debt, it's like, well, that's true, but we have debt. And it's not going away.
So investing in Woolworths, the maths would change dramatically if they had to pay back all that debt and fund the money with
shares. But they're not going to. They're not going to.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So and the other. So I think the reality is, if let's take to my own point, let's take a holistic approach here. The gross and net margins of Woolies are superior. They're best in class globally. Yep. They're better than most in the US and the UK and other places in the world. They are. Fact.
Yep.
Return on equity is way up the top there, one of the best. Return on capital, no slouch either, right? Maybe not as attractive as return on equity, but still it's good. Yeah. So I think you can objectively say that this is a company whose profitability is in among the top of its cohort globally.
Yep.
Now, that's just fact.
Yep.
It's a different question to say whether or not that's appropriate or not. So this is where things sort of get a bit murky. And again, I would make the point, it's just like, well, that's their job is to maximize the return to shareholders. So I don't know. It's all a little bit of a circus. It's one of these things too let's wave our magic wand and let's reduce their profitability to the lowest amongst the global cohort, but make them still profitable so they're viable. You've made the point before. Well, great. You know, your weekly shopping bill might drop 5%.
No. I mean, if it dropped 5%, they would be unprofitable.
Yeah. So it drops 2%. Inflation
2%
problem
is $4 in a $200 grocery shop.
The cost of living problem has not gone away. It's gotten slightly better.
Exactly.
Slightly better. Yeah. Yeah. And again, this is why it frustrates me. It's like, let's talk about the causal factor here,
correct,
you know?
Correct.
It's like all of this money that's just sloshing around and we're doing more of it. We're talking about stimulating things and all of this stuff in an economy with 3.5% unemployment. Like, look over there. It's the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world it didn't exist. And that's what government done. The greatest trick it's ever done is convince the world that it's not playing a hand in this kind of stuff. Yeah. So can we finish off
quickly with Woodside? This is another can of worms, and it could go for a long or a short amount of time. But I just want to talk about it because I thought it was an interesting knot to try and untie. There's a lot of people who would invest on so-called ESG, environmental, social, and governance grounds. It's a new big thing. And basically people saying, look, when I do my investing, I'm going to look at the company's environmental record. I'm going to look at the impact it has on the world around it, whether it's, you know, using slave labor in China or you know, whatever it's doing socially. I'm going to look at its governance, make sure the board is comprised appropriately of experts and has a diverse board and all that kind of stuff. There's a whole lot of different ways to look at this ESG lens, but it's becoming more and more popular. And companies, for the most part, are responding to it, partly because regulators are making them, partly because they want to be attractive to shareholders. And they say, well, actually, look at this board. Look at our environmental track record. Here's our report on ESG itself. Here's our environmental report. All that. So these things are having an impact on companies. And then you get Woodside. Now, Richard Goyder, and by the way, this is the vote's happening after we finished here, so I don't know whether Richard Goyder will still be the chair of Woodside in 2 days' time when you hear this. Mm. He is up for re-election. And there's a large number of institutional shareholders, pension funds, superannuation funds, who are voting against his re-election because the company doesn't have an appropriate climate change strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am on the record very clearly as saying climate change is real, the scientists are right, and we should do something about climate change. I also am on the record of saying I don't think ESG matters a lot because whether I own BHP shares or Woodside shares or not, someone's going to. So my money on ESG grounds is not going to make a huge difference. But I don't want to really talk about any of those at the moment, mate. You're welcome to. The thing that really piqued my interest is Woodside, for those who don't know, is a gas and oil driller. Okay? It is literally in
the... How do you have an environmental policy? Like,
this is my thing. So I don't... And if the answer is... If the shareholders are so worried about the existential reality, i.e. when governments stop people using fossil fuels, Woodside goes broke, that's fine. I don't know what they expect Woodside to do. What do they want them to go into making, you know, fluffy pens with little things on them? You've got, or is it, do they want them to become a competitor to Woolworths? I'm not making light of the environmental realities here. If the government started to shut down Woodside, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
But if you're a shareholder and somehow wanting the company to have some sort of environmental strategy that is somehow having fossil fuel-free fossil fuels, good luck to you, because I'm not sure how that works. I don't think any scientist got that answer.
No,
not ridiculous. Only that, mate, so that's the first thing, right? So if you're a shareholder, you've got other shareholders who are, I think, if you don't like what they're doing, don't buy the shares. Like, I get that. If you want to make government change, do it. Trying to kind of blow it up from the inside, it's not what they would say they're doing, but trying to reduce their profit or somehow find a new Woodside, which is in the business of rainbows and puppy dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, good luck to you, but it just seems weird to me that that would be a desirable thing and that you'd actually hold shares and then still try and make that happen. And I think if you're an investor in Woodside or any company, this is actually one of the newer, I'm not sure how big the risk ends up being, but it's a new risk you need to be aware of, is what are other shareholders trying to do with your company? And normally it wouldn't be a question you would have asked. I don't think at any point in the last 100 years anyone said, hey, I own shares in General Motors. Maybe, you know, 1950s. There's a group of people inside who are trying to stop us making cars. Do I want to own these shares?
Yeah.
And I think it's just worth as an investor thinking that through. The other thing, by the way, I think, and this is where it gets pretty dystopian, is what happens to companies like these guys or Whitehaven Coal? Well, eventually, if the shareholder pressure is too much, they become private companies again.
Mm-hmm.
And then these shareholders who are trying to make a change have absolutely no access to these companies. They operate in the shadows, not on the public markets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we kind of want to be careful what we wish for a little bit because, think about some of the unlisted fossil fuel businesses out there, the unlisted businesses that are in coal or something else. I don't know whether they are, frankly, Hancock. If you don't like iron ore mining, no reason not to, but if you don't, Gina's doing her thing and no one sees the public records. No one gets to vote or anything. She's not accountable to anybody. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But if you think Woodside should do something differently and it decides to delist or move to America or something else, I just think it's a really complex area, mate. And I think the simplistic ESG is bad, therefore X is fine. But the implications of that are, don't stop there, I don't think.
I'm so against all of this ESG nonsense. And I've really got to explain myself there because...
Good idea.
I'm very much...
The headline quote. Andrew Page of Strawman says. Go on.
I love the idea of it.
Yeah.
But the trouble is it just gets gamed. It's a massive game of virtue signaling. Look what we're doing. Look what we're doing. And guess what? They're only going to highlight the stuff that's all fantastic. And it's kind of like, no company produces an ESG report that says, oh, we're just screwing the environment. And, like, it's just all white dudes, old white dudes at the bottom. Like, no, they will sing the praise and they will all be fantastic. And the consultants come in and they get a little cut of it. There's more snouts in the trough here that are trying. And it just so someone can feel good about their investments. And it's kind of like, I think if you want to invest through an ESG lens, I commend you, and I do myself. Like, there are certain companies I just won't invest in. But I don't need the company's ESG report or some independent consultant to tell me this. It's just like, and I'm certainly not.
Yeah.
I'm not investing in Woodside if that's a concern for me, right? But so it's kind of a bit like it's like our carbon accounting scheme. It's just completely gamed by the investment bankers. And the end result is that more carbon's going into the air now than it ever has before. But look, you know, we've got this mechanism here that means that we can only do this and that. And it's like, it's all an accounting trickery. So it's very easy to get cynical on all of this kind of stuff. Mm. And it drives me mad. Just so we can all feel a little bit better about ourselves without actually making any change whatsoever. Do you know?
That's my issue with ESG, bro, even the so-called ethical investing in general, is that that idea of I move my shares from X to Y, therefore I'm improving the world. It's like, no, you're kind of happy with what you're investing in. You've had literally, I know you slightly disagree, but to my mind, you've had literally bugger all impact on anything. Yeah. You just give yourself a pat on the back. You go to you sleep better in bed. You smile a bit brighter in the morning and nothing has changed. Like, nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And yet you've convinced yourself you're changing. And speaking of greenwashing, fund managers sell this stuff.
Oh.
You know, some mob, I want to be careful. No, I won't name the specifics, effectively promoted themselves as investors save this much carbon emissions or whatever because of the portfolio construction. It's like, no, someone still owns those shares. The companies didn't produce any of this carbon. You just own less of them. That doesn't change. The environment doesn't say, oh, I feel so much better about myself now. Same amount of carbon, but at least John Smith changed his investing strategy.
It's a marketing tool.
The world's better. It is, isn't it? And at higher bloody fees too. That's what really gets up my nose, is they charge more fees because that value signaling comes with a higher price tag. People are willing to pay it because they think they're improving the world.
Yep.
It's a very, very, very dodgy way to do it.
Now, that all being said, should Woodside or any fossil fuel company have a long-term strategy to deal with a transition? Yes. Yes, 100,000 times yes, because whether it's like it or not, that, you know, the world that we live in is sort of going too slowly, but generally in the right direction. And you need to have a long-term strategy around that. And it's completely a dereliction of your duties and pure negligence if you don't. But this is the state of the world. This is where go to where the puck is going to be, you know, and it's going in that direction. So position yourself for it.
Yep.
The best example here is the cigarette companies, Altria and the rest.
That's right,
of it. They handled it really well. You know, they made they minimized their reinvestment in their plant and equipment. They kept it running, but no new investment. Yep. They diversified into other areas, and they fought it. They fought it tooth and nail, and they're absolute.
Careful.
trying to think of a clean word. You know, I've got no
bad
love.
People.
No love. They are bad people, right? Like they are bringing harm to the world. Yep. But they were rational in the way that they manage their business. Yep. And I would argue that if I was an investor in these companies, I would want them to have some kind of a plan for the reality that they find themselves in. Mm. But just leave the virtue signaling aside, right? You know, I feel it's sort of like the whole thing has been hijacked. So PR consultants and marketers have something else to go to market with. And it is don't be suckered into these badges, because it really doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's the other tricky part with it too is, particularly on the, a lot of this stuff, it's very subjective in the interpretation of it, you know? I mean, just to play with the example in the space that we are, let's say that for whatever reason, they're just going to, let's just get rid of all fossil fuels tomorrow. It's like, great, less carbon in the air, brilliant. Crippling global depression that lasts for decades and our standard of living collapses back
poverty
to the stone
and
age.
Unnecessary deaths, yeah.
Just reality, yeah. Right? So it's just something you can't do quickly. So it's sort of, you have to balance all of these different competing things.
Which, again, is not you saying we shouldn't do it, just we should do it as quickly as we possibly can, but no quicker.
Absolutely, right?
Yeah.
And there's trade-offs and there's costs and there's all of these other kinds of things. But, you know, this is just a bunch of people in the financial space trying to sort of all pretend that they're all holier than thou and look at them. We're getting rid of this evil man here because of this. And I'm like, dude, how can he possibly have... It's like the cigarette companies having a health policy. You know, I was like,
that's right.
What?
And, that's right. We watch about a smoking cessation policy.
Yeah, yeah. Like it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't. So,
exactly.
I do lament it. Again, just for the sake of clarity here, I'm very big on investing in things that you want to see more of in the world and not investing in things you want to see less of. My argument is that the fringe, it does make a difference, because if enough people are against it, they'll, shares will trade at a lower premium. that infers a higher cost of capital. That makes business a little bit more tricky. And it's a little bit of a headwind, right? Like, it's not a game changer in and of itself. But if Woodside was if Woodside was trading consistently on a PE multiple, it was double what it currently is, it could do a hell of a lot more. And so you can have a bit of an impact. Just don't let others tell you what's ethical and what's not. Like, make your own interpretation.
Yeah, fair. Nicely put, mate. I reckon that might do us for today. Will you join me again on Sunday?
Yeah, let's do it. 100%.
All right. Until then, enjoy the first half of your weekend and fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.